Welcome to a very special presentation of the novel A Really Good Day by James Hosek. On its surface, it's a story about a remarkable round of golf. But if you're not a golfer, if you quickly change the channel, if you accidentally come upon a tournament on TV, I encourage you to listen anyway. It's a story about family and friendship. It's a story about redemption and second chances. It's a story about promises made and promises kept. It's a story about once-in-a-lifetime experiences. But most of all, it is one man's love letter to his family. That man was my brother, the author, James Hosek. Aside from being an amazing veterinarian, woodworker, gardener, husband, father, brother, son, and friend, he was a writer. Writers are often told to write what they know. And in this, his first book, he did that in more ways than I can count. It will make you laugh. It will make you cry. And it will make you stand up and cheer. So sit back and enjoy as Jim takes you on a fun, entertaining journey through 18 holes of golf and one man's really good day. Chapter 11. Ninth hole. Scott looked down the ninth fairway. It was the longest par four on the front nine at 440 yards. What's more, the fairway was wide open to either side and stretched out straight downhill. He could hit the ball almost anywhere and still have a decent approach to the green with his second shot. The green itself was large, and the flag was placed nearly dead center. Anywhere he landed on the green would give him a chance at an easy two-putt. If he could end the first nine holes still six under par, he'd be very happy. It certainly wasn't impossible. But he was starting to think too much. What if he did this? What if he did that? Paul was right in telling him that his game was affected more by psychology than mechanics. Still, his last drive haunted him. He needed to get a nice straight drive. He needed to know he still had those shots in him. To his left, he could see the driving range. It was deserted now. All the golfers were currently on the course. 20 groups of three, 60 golfers. The 60th rated player was now leading. He remembered his lesson on the range earlier that morning and had an idea. He handed his driver to Paul and knelt on the grass and untied his left shoelace. While the crowd around him watched in confusion, he cinched the shoelace with a jerk and tied it down as tight as he could. Paul handed him back the driver. He remembered Scott telling him about Ted Lang's little trick, and he figured at this point it couldn't hurt. Scott placed his ball on a tee and placed the club directly behind it. No practice swings this time. Scott was no longer on the ninth tee. He was at the driving range. And a strange old man had just had him tie his shoelace so tight it was hurting him. Suddenly, in his mind, the image of a ball sailing straight out from the practice tee and rolling up against the fence 275 yards away filled his mind. It happened in slow motion. He looked down. A ball was on the tee. Something was wrong with his left foot, but he couldn't remember what it was. Muscles in his back and shoulders and legs started moving his body into position. His eyes remained focused on the ball. There was no duck, just a red stripe marking it as a range ball, for practice only. The club had disappeared from view, but he sensed it hovering over his left shoulder. And like a sledgehammer hurtling down on a rock, he felt his body uncoil, and the ball was gone. He looked, and there was no practice range, no field of balls littering the grass, no large block numbers labeling the distance the ball had traveled. A tiny white flag waved in the distance. There were people surrounding the green, stunned into awed silence. "Ow, my foot," thought Scott, but his eyes stayed glued to the ball. The ball sailed out and continued to rise and rise, and then seemed to hang in the air. the ball was still flying away, getting smaller with each passing moment, until it came down to the ground and rolled, taking full advantage of the hill's slope. It was still rolling when applause erupted from around the tee, echoed by the spectators around the green. Still, the ball refused to stop until it had eked out every inch of distance it could. "Where did that come from?" Paul asked. "I don't know," answered Scott honestly. It had to be the longest drive he had ever hit in his life. A set of white stakes marked the distance 150 yards from the center of the green, and his ball was 25 yards past them. He had just slammed it out 315 yards. It wasn't a world record, and there were undoubtedly others here that could match the feat. But to Scott, it was his best shot of the day. Better than the hole-in-one. That was luck. Better than his long putt for birdie. Better than his chip shot on two for par. He had hit the ball perfectly and had gotten every bit of distance his body and club and ball could offer. With a stinging reminder from his left foot, he bent down, untied and loosened the lace, then retied it normally. He walked with a slight limp from the tee and smiled at Jerry Spalding, who stepped up to follow Scott's incredible drive.
"Is that how it's done?"
he asked. Scott's smile widened. "It's all downhill," he replied. Joe Culkin observed Scott Hanover retying his shoe on the tee. Ted Lang grinned as he watched Scott repeat the exercise he had used before to get him to balance his brain for his swing.
"Watch this," he prompted Joe.
They watched as the amateur golfer robotically swung as perfect a swing as either of them had ever seen. And for a moment, as the ball flew through the air, it looked as though it might land at their feet. The ground was hard enough, and the ball hit with just the right angle that it rolled for nearly 50 yards before coming to a stop.
"Wow," said Joe.
"Wow indeed," agreed Ted.
Jerry's drive veered to the left and was off the fairway, but safely away from the trees and perhaps 200 yards from the green. Pete's sliced to the right and rolled between some short pine trees, leaving him no clear shot to the green. As the group moved off the tee, a massive crowd of people followed them. There were perhaps 50 people there and another 50 around the green. Word was spreading. Hanover had just nailed a monster drive on the ninth hole and was coming in. Everyone who didn't have to be somewhere else was migrating over to watch him play the rest of the hole. The area in front of the scoreboard, until now their only way to keep track of Hanover's progress, was quickly deserted. Pete decided to play it safe and hit his ball back to the fairway instead of trying to find a direct route through the trees to the green. His ball landed about 5 yards behind Scott's. Jerry had a good line to the green but was 200 yards away. His second shot took him on and off the back of the green, but only a good chip and putt away from par. Pete Baldwin placed his third shot on the green, but 5 yards from the pin. He was on in three. Scott was ready for his second shot. Paul handed him his pitching wedge, and Scott once again resumed his normal routine of lining up the shot and taking two practice swings. He swung at the ball, and someone in the crowd yelled, "It's in the hole!" for luck. The ball soared almost straight up, heading for the pin, landing 3 yards in front of it, rolling past the hole 2 inches from the edge of the cup, and stopping 3 feet behind it. Scott shook his head in disbelief. As long as his drive had been, this shot was straight. 2 inches to the left, and it might have gone in. Applause had erupted again. Scott felt strangely unaffected by the cheers and attention. "Two putts," he thought. "Two putts. Just get par and stay 6 under, and you'll have the best 9 holes you ever shot in your life." Scott's only competition had always been with himself. Even when he and Paul played, he didn't care if Paul always won. If he could just have a little better score than the last time he played, that would be a great accomplishment. He didn't track his handicap after every game. He just looked at his total score and tried to take every hole one stroke at a time. Scott walked on the green, placed his small penny on the grass behind his ball, and picked it up. He handed it to Paul to be checked for damage and to clean off any debris that might interfere with it rolling straight. Jerry chipped his ball onto the green and was still 2 yards away from the cup when it stopped rolling, but definitely doable, Scott thought. Pete putted to within a foot of the hole and quickly tapped his ball in to get off in 5. Better than the last hole, but adding one stroke to the plus side of his total score. Jerry hit his ball and it followed Pete's into the cup, completing his second par in a row. He was still 10 strokes over, 9 of them from one hole. Even without that whole mess, he would be far behind Hanover. Scott walked up to his marker, put his ball in the same position he had picked it up from earlier, and pocketed the penny. He looked at the green carefully. Then he looked at Paul, who shrugged, obviously content to stick to metaphysical advice rather than practical. But Scott could hear his words nonetheless. Put it in the hole. He lined up his feet, swung the putter like a pendulum to set his speed, and with cool, deliberate precision, he did just that. He put the ball in the hole. Another birdie. Scott Hanover was now 7 strokes under par. 7. It took him a while to notice that the crowd had once again erupted in cheers, and even Jerry and Pete were clapping at the accomplishment. Scott walked 2 steps over to the hole and pulled out the ball. He held it up like he had seen the pros do on television and waved it around and smiled and cried. What a wonderful, beautiful day. And it was only half over.
Tell me you have it all, begged Jason. He was a different man from the one Ellie had met in the parking garage this morning. She nodded. We need to get some footage of Patterson in case things go bad.
He's already teed off, pointed out Ellie. Let me edit out the hole-in-one and satellite it in. Then I can catch up with Patterson down the course.
Jason considered her idea and nodded in agreement. Okay, I should probably get some words from Hanover.
Ellie told him about some of the events on the course, and Jason smiled. This guy was going to make this story shine. Screw the marathon. Ellie looked around and saw Scott Hanover and his caddy, Paul, going over his scorecard. She waved and Scott noticed her. She motioned him over and he walked over to the camera woman.
This is Jason Bernard, she said, introducing the two men. Jason, this is Scott Hanover.
Great to meet you, said Jason as he shook Scott's hand firmly. Great round so far, eh?
Yeah.
Listen, we want to get some tape of you before you head off again, for the sports report.
Terrific, said Scott.
Jason looked at Ellie. Is here okay?
She motioned Jason to his left to get a better angle to the sun and hefted the camera to her shoulder.
Ready.
Jason began an impromptu introduction, and his professional skills and presence took over. Ellie was impressed with how easily he flowed into his on-camera personality.
We're here at George Dunn National Golf Course in Oak Forest, Illinois, for the Northern Illinois Amateur Regional Golf Tournament. The winner today will get a slot in the next PGA Pro-Am tournament, a dream that most amateurs will never realize. But golfer Scott Hanover is giving a lot of duffers a vicarious thrill with his incredible round today, and an amazing shot on the 7th hole, which we'll show you in a moment. He turned to Scott. You're now 7 strokes under par, an incredible accomplishment for a professional golfer, let alone an amateur. Scott, did you ever think you'd be doing this well after the first 9 holes?
Scott looked at the camera and took a breath. No way, he answered honestly. I've had a bunch of lucky shots.
Do you think it'll hold up?
I don't know, but even if it doesn't, today will be a day I will always remember.
On the 7th hole, Jason glanced down at a scorecard he had grabbed from the clubhouse earlier, a 190-yard par 3, you did something most golfers only dream of. What did it feel like?
Like you said, most golfers only dream of getting a hole-in-one. I've come close a bunch of times, but when I hit the ball, I was sure it was going to zoom off the green.
What happened?
It hit the flagstick head-on and just dropped in. Like I said, a lucky shot.
Well, luck or not, it's the same score, pointed out Jason.
Yeah.
How long have you been golfing?
About 20 years, since college.
Were you on your college team?
Scott laughed. Not likely.
Looking forward to maybe playing with the pros?
Well, it'd be nice to win, but I'm afraid today will be my last game for a while.
Jason looked confused.
Scott continued. My wife, Sarah, is expecting our first child in a couple of weeks, and my time is going to be taken up with my family.
I'm sure your wife would understand, suggested Jason.
You don't know my wife. Besides, I promised, and I intend to keep that promise. A round like today is not how I usually play, and I would be way out of my league in a professional tournament.
Perhaps when your son or daughter is older.
Perhaps, smiled Scott.
Do you want to tell us a little about the quacking?
Scott laughed. Well, it started out as a private joke with my caddy, Paul Bauer. When we first started golfing years ago, I guess I had a tendency to hit balls into the water whenever we found some on the course. He called me the duck and made sure to give me a reminder quack whenever water was in play. Some of the observers today picked up on it, and it helped me shed some of the nerves I was getting. Well, until the official put a stop to it.
He wouldn't let the people quack?
Well, I think it was starting to annoy him a little, to tell the truth.
Does Paul have a nickname?
Scott laughed again. Paul has always been Zorro. He uses a black glove and green tees, which he loaned me today. Oh, he also had some special balls made.
Special?
Scott pulled out a duck logo ball and held it up. Ellie zoomed in and held the shot for a moment.
Very nice, commented Jason.
He looked back into the camera.
Well, Duck, let's take a look at that amazing hole-in-one earlier today.
He paused for a moment.
Cut. Okay, now we'll do a throwback and head for the truck. This is Jason Bernard, reporting from George Dunn National Golf Course.
Another pause.
Okay, Scott, thanks. We'll see you at the 10th hole.
Can I get a copy of all this? You'll get everything I have, promised Ellie. Jason shook Scott's hand once more, and Ellie shook it as well. They headed off to the parking lot, and the USA sports truck parked there. Paul came up behind Scott.
You're going to be on TV, he said.
My 15 minutes, said Scott.
You keep playing like this, maybe more than that.
Mr. Hanover, called an urgent voice.
Scott turned to see a large man wearing a red jacket with a white plastic name badge pinned to the lapel.
Terrific round so far.
Scott didn't know what to say.
I guess, he muttered.
The man seemed a little hesitant, like he was there to do more than just compliment Scott on his golf game. He had some news, and Scott had no idea if it was good or bad.
Usually, he continued, we try to group golfers to allow the better golfers to finish last. You know, have some head-to-head competition. Makes for a better tournament.
Makes sense, agreed Scott.
You were rated last among all the golfers today, yet you're way ahead of the rest so far.
I still am rated last, pointed out Scott.
Yes, regardless, one of the officials will need to check your equipment.
Excuse me? Asked Scott.
Just to make sure it falls within the USGA regulations. I'd hate to see you disqualified.
Disqualified? Shouldn't that have been checked out earlier?
Technically, there's no time limit to when a violation can be discovered, but we just want to make sure.
You think I'm cheating? Scott asked angrily.
No, no, but we need to make sure that if any accusations are made, we can say you are well within the USGA rules.
Check away.
Carl Bateman motioned another red-jacketed man to check the bag Paul was standing next to.
There's one other thing, added Bateman. Provided everything checks out okay, we'd like to pull you out of your current threesome to play in a final twosome with whomever has the next highest score. Provided, of course, you're still in the running after everyone has come in from the front nine.
But that could be 2 hours or more, realized Scott. I'll lose my momentum.
The statement sounded stupid the second Scott said it. Momentum? He could scarcely call his performance on the course anything that he had planned or had control over.
Well, yes, and normally we don't want to destroy the rhythm a golfer may have developed,
but if you don't mind.
What if I do mind? Asked Scott, wondering what might happen if he fought the official's decision.
Technically, we can disqualify you. We do have the ability to change grouping and order in the middle of the match.
I'm sure you do, but how would that look? Scott pointed out. The USA Sports people just interviewed me. If you pulled me out, well, a lot of people might be starting to think that you want one of the favorites to win rather than a nobody.
Not at all, not at all, Bateman said, backpedaling. We want the people who came out here today to see the best matchups we can provide. It makes for a more dramatic finish if the best scorers round out the tournament.
I suppose it makes sense from your point of view, agreed Scott.
Who knows, maybe having some stiffer competition will help your game.
Scott laughed. I can't see myself doing any better than I already have.
Yes, well, you're probably right about that, muttered Bateman.
Well, considered Scott, it seems like I really don't have much of a choice anyway. Do what you gotta do.
Thank you, Mr. Hanover. Grab some lunch. Relax. We'll find you when we need you,
Carl instructed. He walked about 20 feet to a golf cart and drove off. What was that? Paul asked. I guess we're taking a break. You know, you can't really do anything. You can't practice putting at the putting green or hit balls at the driving range. Really? I think you can chip around the 10th tee, but that's while you're waiting to tee off. Well, then let me buy you lunch. Excellent idea.
Sarah and Anna made arrangements to pick up their furniture the next week. Sarah's contractions were still persisting, but were once again tolerable.
Same thing happened to me, said Anna when Sarah had asked her about it. It was a false labor. I dragged Dale to the hospital and they sent me back home. I didn't have Linus for another 10 days.
Sounds reassuring, Sarah said.
You'll be fine, assured Anna.
When I finally went into labor, it lasted 22 hours.
You'll have plenty of time when it does happen, trust me.
They browsed for a while longer among the pickings left by the earliest shoppers. Anna ended up buying some children's books, and Sarah found a few more stuffed animals to add to the collection that had built up in the nursery thanks to a baby shower, hand-me-downs, and favorites Sarah had saved from her childhood. This kid was in definite danger of being buried for days under a fake fur avalanche if the trend continued.
"What's going on over there?" Anna asked.
Sarah looked where Anna was pointing to the rows of televisions they had passed previously. A group of people, mostly men, were mesmerized by the scene on the screens multiplied dozens of times, like the reflection in a fly's compound eye. A man was walking toward them and shaking his head.
"Some guy hit a hole in one,"
he mentioned, assuming they would be interested in the explanation.
"Too bad Scott's missing that," commented Sarah.
"What, like Tiger Woods or someone?" "Nah, some guy playing in an amateur tournament. He's walking away with it after 9 holes. Winner gets a chance to play in a pro tournament," he added before walking away.
"Hey, that sounds like the one Scott is playing in. Oh, dear, I hope he's not doing too badly. Sounds like there are some really good guys playing. I wonder if Scott got to see it when he was there."
"Blah," gagged Anna. "He's probably sitting in the clubhouse watching it on TV with Paul."
"Let's see if they show Scott playing in the background or something."
Anna looked at her watch.
"We really should be going, Sarah." "It'll just take a minute," she argued. "Let's hurry before they move on to another story."
She pulled Anna by the hand and led her through the thinning crowd. And apparently, a neatly groomed, well-dressed anchorman commented as Sarah got close enough to see one of the screens. His caddy had nicknamed him the Duck because of his propensity to hit the ball into any water on the course.
"And he did fulfill that prophecy on the 8th hole,
added a too bouncy blonde anchor whose painted red lips pulled out to a perfect smile over her bright white teeth. But he still managed to pull off a par, despite the penalty stroke, the first sportscaster remarked.
"That's funny," Sarah mentioned to Anna. "Paul calls Scott the Duck, too." She paused for a moment. "They can't be talking. I thought you said Scott was out of his league with these guys."
Suddenly, Sarah's husband's picture filled half the screen, next to a man holding a microphone with the USA Sports logo prominently displayed.
"I've had a bunch of lucky shots,"
Scott said to the television audience.
The camera cut away, and Scott was standing at a tee, getting ready to swing. He hit the ball, and the camera followed it jerkily until it focused on the flag on the green. The ball hit the flag and dropped into the hole. The camera zoomed in, making it clear the ball had indeed gone in.
"There it is once again," commented the first anchor. "Scott Hanover's amazing hole-in-one. As he said himself, one heck of a lucky shot."
Sarah's jaw dropped. "Oh my God," she muttered. "Did you see that?"
"Everybody's seen it, lady," commented a man standing near her.
"That was my husband," she said. "He's on TV."
He turned to her.
"No kidding? Wow, what a day he's having. 7 under par for 9 holes. If he keeps that up, he'll break the professional golf record for 18 holes.
"Record?"
asked Sarah.
"Yeah, apparently he was in the first group to tee off, but they're making him wait to finish so they can put him head-to-head with a golfer doing as well, or at least close to him.
USA Sports says they're going to come back in a couple of hours to show stroke-by-stroke coverage of the back nine."
Sarah looked at Anna. "I have to go there," she announced, resolute and firm. "I have to be there." Anna smiled and chuckled. "I thought you hated golf." "I do, Anna. But I love Scott. I think it would mean a lot to him if I were there. He promised this would be his last round of golf for a long time. He's on TV, Anna," she added, trying to convince her sister. "Sarah, I have to get home and start getting ready for my dinner party tonight." "That's okay. I'll go by myself." "You can't go by yourself. What about your contractions?" "You said yourself they're nothing to worry about." "Did I hear you say that was your husband?" asked a familiar voice. It was Sally, the extraordinarily nice salesperson who had helped them earlier. "Yes," said Sarah, grinning proudly. "That guy interviewing him, Jason Bernard, he's my husband," she explained almost as proudly as Sarah. "Why don't I take you to the tournament? I'm sure Jason could get you out with the golfers, especially since he's covering the story." "Do you think it would be hard to get on the course?" She nodded her head. "Every amateur golfer in the area is going to be rushing down there to see your husband finish his round. It's really turning out to be a huge story. And Jason was worried he got stuck with this golf tournament as a punishment," she added. "Besides, I have another reason for going." "What's that?" "That woman who was working with me, Cecily?" Sarah thought for a moment, then remembered the first woman who had offered help when she was looking at rockers. She shook as she recalled her rudeness and stuffy demeanor. "Her fiancé is playing in that tournament, too. If your husband can beat him, I'll do whatever I can to see that moment." Sarah laughed and turned to Anna. "Anna, go on home. I'll get a lift from Sally." "2 hot dogs," ordered Paul, "and a large Pepsi." "Same here," added Scott. The young teenage girl working at the lunch counter smiled and rang the orders up on her cash register, then turned to get them ready. The hot dogs were twirling between a set of rollers on the counter behind her. She pulled 4 buns from the steamer and placed them on separate sheets of waxed paper, then loaded the hot dogs from the warmer with a set of tongs, laying them in the warm buns. She wrapped each dog and placed them on a tray near the cash register. 2 large styrofoam cups were dragged through a bin of ice before she set them under the soda dispenser until the foam dripped over the sides. $11, she said with her unflappable smile. Scott reached into his wallet and pulled out a 10 and a single and handed them to the girl. He slipped another 2 singles into a pickle jar labeled tips.
Thanks, she said. You're the guy, right? The one on TV?
Scott turned around and noted the 35-inch television in the corner turned to USA Sports. A report on the Chicago Marathon was currently playing, but a crawl on the bottom of the screen promised shot-by-shot coverage of the Northern Illinois Amateur Regional Golf Tournament later in the day.
I guess I am.
She pulled a scorecard from under the counter and a pen from next to the cash register.
Can I get your autograph?
She asked shyly.
Who knows, it might be worth something someday.
Paul laughed.
I'm sorry, he apologized. It just struck me as funny.
Scott cautioned him with a look and took the offered pen.
What's your name?
He asked.
Cassie, she replied.
He wrote, "To Cassie, best wishes and thanks for the dogs, Scott Hanover."
There, he said. Thanks for asking.
Cassie looked pleased at the scorecard. Good luck the rest of the round, she said. I'll take all the luck I can get, he answered. When they were out of earshot, Paul teased. She likes you, Scott. Shut up, Scott said. They stepped over to the condiment table, and Scott pumped some mustard onto his dogs and slathered them with relish and onions. I'm just saying, continued Paul, adding a layer of ketchup over his tube steaks. Eat your hot dogs, instructed Scott as they sat down at a table. No sooner had they settled in when another man slipped himself into one of the two empty chairs around the table. Better get used to that, he warned. Scott seemed puzzled. The autographs. Could be someday you'll be tired of signing them. I doubt it, Scott said, laughing. I'm Jake Fisher. He held out his hand and Scott wiped some mustard from his before shaking. Scott Hanover, this is my caddy, Paul Bauer. Paul's handshake left a little ketchup on Jake's hand, but Jake politely ignored it. I know. You've had an amazing round so far. Amazing is the word, Scott agreed. Are you playing? No, just watching. I'm a sports agent. Like Jerry Maguire? Piped in Paul. Jake chuckled. Not quite. Show me the money, grunted Paul, continuing his parody. Well, started Jake, I'd like to talk to you about some sort of agreement. Scott stopped in mid-bite and put down his hot dog. You want to represent me? He asked. Yes. Why? Asked Scott incredulously. You're the kind of sportsman I look for. Lucky? Paul asked jokingly. Genuine, answered Jake. You play because you love the game. You're already a hero to thousands of golfers this morning, and that number will grow before you hit the 10th tee. USA Sports is going to play this up to draw attention from the marathon scandal, and you have won a place in today's events, whether you win the tournament or not. Marathon scandal? Paul asked. Some kid took an early lead and then almost died from a drug overdose, explained Jake. I'm not going to win, pointed out Scott. You don't have to win. Just have fun. Callaway wants a real weekend golfer that people can identify with. I think that's you. Other people think it may be someone else out here today. But I have an eye for these things. The golf guys, Callaway? Interrupted Paul. That's the Callaway, answered Jake. Paul let out a low, long whistle. Scott seemed impressed, too, but explained further. Well, even if I win, I can't play the pro-am. I'll be on labor watch. Labor watch? Asked Jake. Scott and his wife Sarah are expecting their first kid in a few weeks. Scott promised there'd be no more golf for a while. He gave in too easily, though, if you ask me. Nobody asked you, jibed Scott. Congratulations, Scott, Jake said. That's great. Listen, I can't promise you'll get rich from this. You can't because you're an amateur, but there are alternate ways to compensate you. Perhaps a college fund for your kid? But we can talk about that later. No one's going to care if you play in the pro-am after what you've done today. You're a Cinderella, an unknown, showing up at the ball with a carriage drawn by ducks. You're the kind of guy Callaway needs. Take a ride with me, and I promise you'll have some fun along the way. I really don't think anyone would be interested in me, Scott argued. Let me take care of that part. Jake pulled a stack of papers folded into thirds from his pocket. Sign a letter of exclusivity with me. It won't commit you to any endorsements or sign over your life. It just means I have the first right of refusal to represent you if any offers come along. It can't hurt, pointed out Paul. I'd do it. Can't hurt, agreed Jake. For the second time in less than 10 minutes, Scott gave his autograph. Andrew Patterson's tee shot on the second hole landed in the middle of the fairway. He knew he could par this hole with a perfect approach shot. Without words, his caddy handed him his 8-iron. Andrew didn't even check if it was the right club. He didn't need to line up the shot. He had a natural sense of where to put his feet. It was like his body was programmed to play golf. If only he had found this sport earlier. But there was still time to make his mark, and it would start today. He popped the ball up neatly onto the green, and a slight backspin pulled it within a yard of the hole. The putt would be simple for him. A light tap, and it was in. There were a few people crowded around him, with more coming now that Hanover had finished, and they wanted to see what Patterson would do in the face of Scott's 7 strokes under par score. Andrew knew that a score like that was due entirely to luck, especially from such a low-rated player. Luck had a habit of changing. He would finish the front 9 3 under, maybe 4, possibly 5 if he had some luck of his own on a chip shot or two. But his steady, consistent style would bring him the win, as it always had. Thank you for listening to A Really Good Day, a novel by James Hosick, narrated by Rich Hosick. If you are interested in purchasing a hardcover edition of this story for yourself or a golfer in your life, visit jimbooks.myshopify.com. You'll get free shipping in the United States. You'll also get the complete audiobook and ebook editions with your purchase. And make sure to subscribe to the mailing list for updates about the upcoming release of his Doctor at Mystery series, Cozy Mysteries about a Crime-Solving Veterinarian. Thanks again, and all the very best.